Members, we're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. We've got a full list here today. We're going to start off with the Minnesota Racing Commission. However, there's just a couple of housekeeping items that I want to remind everybody. If you're from the Racing Commission, please come forward. So tomorrow we do not have a committee. And then on Tuesday we are going to be doing a joint hearing with the Senate to discuss the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority. So with that, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record. Oh, we got to do minutes. Oh, first time ever I think I've ever forgotten the minutes. We've got the minutes from January 31st. Representative Ward, you want to move those minutes for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I so move.
Okay, we've got the January 31st minutes before us. Anybody opposed to them? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Great. Thanks, guys. with that, if you guys can start us off, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and I have with me Joe Sturdo, who's the Deputy Director of the Racing Commission. We're going to take you through the finances of the commission today, but maybe especially for those of you who may be new to the committee or new to state government, it might be worth just taking a few minutes to describe the activities of the commission and provide a little context for what's happened in the last couple of years and bring you up to where we are today. The commission regulates horse racing at Canterbury Park in the southwest suburbs, thoroughbred and quarter horse racing, and running aces in the northern metro for standardbred racing. We oversee both the racing and the card room activity within those entities, and that amounts to well over $100 million worth of gaming activity each year. We administer about $1.2 million in breeders' funds that get distributed to Minnesota owners and breeders to support the racing industry, and we issue licenses to over 5,000 occupational licensees. For each of those people, we do background checks and ensure that they meet the requirements for licensure in the racing industry. Our operations are primarily financed by the tracks and occupational licensees, so it's essentially a self-funded regulatory entity. Historically, we've not relied on general fund revenue for our operations. We also get reimbursement from the racetracks for certain activities relating to stewards and judges and veterinary work and medication testing to ensure the integrity of racing. And Mr. Skirtle will go into a lot of detail as to how those accounts work and where those revenues flow. What's important that I'd like you to understand is that when I joined the commission in December of 2013, there was a budget shortfall in the commission. And we requested general revenue funds, general funding, and we received that of $341,000 for the last biennium, which was a bridge to legislation that was passed last year, the Advanced Deposit Wagering Law, which will help fill our budget shortfall and meet our operational budget needs for the foreseeable future. So I want to thank the members of this committee that supported that last year. It was a bipartisan bill, and it's having its intended effect. We have six ADW licensees in the state, and those revenues will have already started to flow to the commission and will flow to the racetracks and the breeders and owners of the state to support the industry. So let me just describe. I have in your packet a one-page summary of the activities at the commission in the last year or so. These don't all relate to finance specifically, but I'd like you to know what we're doing with the money that we have. As I said, we are implementing the Advanced Deposit Wagering Bill, which allows people to place wagers on races run outside the state of Minnesota from locations other than the racetrack. We're also regulating that activity to protect Minnesota consumers who may sign up with these providers and to ensure the revenues flow to their proper destinations. We also have intensified our rulemaking. The racing industry moves quickly from year to year, both in terms of the controlled therapeutic medications that are permissible to be used on racehorses and prohibited substances or what might be considered doping. And so it's imperative that we keep our rules up to date so that they reflect the latest in national uniform medication guidelines for horse racing, and we did that last year. We also passed an emergency rule to help mitigate the risk of infectious disease on the backside. There were outbreaks of the herpes virus, equine virus, in Arizona and New Mexico, and we put an emergency rule in place to protect the comings and goings of horses on the backside of the tracks to make sure that we didn't disrupt our own meet. And lastly, at the legislative direction, we implemented expedited rules to regulate advanced deposit wagering, and those rules are now in place. The last thing I'll mention to you is that we're doing an economic impact study, which should be complete in the next couple of weeks, and we'll provide it to the legislature and the governor's office. The last economic impact study that really looked at the impact of the racing and breeding industry in Minnesota was done in 1990. So we asked the University of Minnesota Mankato Extension to do a study, and based on survey data and using the economic impact model that is typically used in these types of studies for state impact, we now know that the economic impact of the state of the racing and breeding industry is about $400 million a year. It's actually more than we anticipated, and one of the reasons for that is that the racing industry has an unusually large indirect economic impact in the state. The horses have to have hay, they need professional veterinary services, boarding and training expenses and the like. So when you add that all up and the money flows through its secondary impacts in the economy, what we learned is that about $176,000 of direct economic impact is attributable to the racing industry, and about $240 million a year is attributable to the secondary effects, which is unusually large compared to other industries. So we'll have that report finalized in the next couple of weeks, and we hope to make it available to the legislature during the session. And we think the value of this report is it helps inform policy decision makers about what's in the best interest of the industry in Minnesota. So with that background, I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Director Joe Skirto, who will give you more background on our finances.
Mr. DePasquale, we have a member question. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I was one of those members that voted in support of your initiative, and am so pleased with what you have done to really shore things up and change the trajectory for Minnesota. I'm just also so pleased to hear what the economic impact is of racing in Minnesota. My question is with regard to rulemaking, and so I'm assuming that your commission has rulemaking authority that was granted to it, or is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have rulemaking authority, and the rules of racing are really aimed at protecting the integrity of racing and the health, safety, and welfare of the participants. Mm-hmm. So we have a fairly comprehensive set of rules that go back to the early 80s. One of the things we're doing, in addition to adding to the rules and keeping them updated, is to delete obsolete rules, and I think you've got the obsolete rule report that we filed with the legislature a few weeks ago.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And so I just have a quick question about the emergency rulemaking that you did. I think you said to mitigate the possibility of an outbreak similar to what occurred in other states. And I'm wondering, from the time that you identified that that would be something that your commission would need to do, how long did that rulemaking process take? And then I have one other quick question unrelated.
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the rulemaking was put in place very quickly. The state provides a process for emergency rulemaking when there's an imminent threat to public health and safety. We learned, I think, probably in the spring months, in the run-up to our race season in Minnesota, which starts in May, of these equine herpes virus outbreaks. And we put a rule in place, I think, really in a matter of weeks. The tracks and our chief veterinarian, Dr. Lynn Hubdo, who's been with the commission for 25 years or more and is a nationally renowned equine vet, worked together to put procedures in place that would have been protective even without an emergency rule, but we felt it was appropriate to have a rule.
Okay.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I'll just stop there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Pugh.
Okay, Mr. Skirto.
Chairman Nash, representatives, Hopefully you've had an opportunity to review our submission, the material submitted in response to your request. And in order to leave time to answer any questions at the end of the presentation, I'd simply like to communicate a couple of items that were impactful in the last year. The first item being our appreciation to this committee for supporting the bridge appropriation 2 years ago and also supporting the industry bill that Mr. DePasquale referred to. It's provided new sources of revenue to fund the agency going forward so we can continue to successfully fulfill our mission. Thanks go to the legislature, governor, and your support. Due to that, the Racing Commission is not requesting any general fund appropriations for the upcoming biennium. That being said, we continue to work hard to control our costs. The Racing Commission has actually reduced overall spending 1% in each of the last two fiscal years. Our staff is continuously looking for ways to invest in people and technology to best offset general increases in costs, from something as simple as renegotiating our copier contracts to optimizing our scheduling. The entire team understands Tom and my directives, and they've been extremely supportive in this measure to help control our costs and stay on budget. In reference to the section submitted regarding interagency agreements, we look at our needs each year, and we try to determine both budgetarily and also our needs which organizations within state government can be helpful to provide services and which we can bring in-house. We decided last year to pull the majority of our legal work in-house via hiring a staff attorney, which has provided our agency quicker execution of rulemaking and the elimination of obsolete rules, plus provide immediate counsel, which is necessary for our stewards and judges that may have questions about things that happen at the racetrack itself. We will continue to use the Attorney General's office for higher-level needs going forward. Conversely, in relation to our financial management and human resources needs, we've extended our agreement with SMART, which provides tremendous value to our agency. Individuals like Micah Intermill, Bruce Lemke, Tracy Sigstag, and Jody Sigelstrom and their teams have provided expertise in operating within the state's financial and human resources systems, and that allows us more time to focus on our core duties. They do it less expensively than if we had to hire our own staff to accomplish these duties, and they also provide a depth of knowledge that would take years for a staff member to ascertain. Working at SMART also provides an additional check and balance when it comes to our internal controls, so everything goes by them to take another look at what we're doing internally. We can address our experiences and budget as it relates to MINUTE, if the chair would like to do that today at the end of the presentation, depending on the time that's available. I know that's a question. So finally, in regard to our staffing, we have a couple of unique operational challenges at the agency due to the seasonality of horse racing itself. Tom and I go from managing 9 full-time people half the year into jumping that staff number up to 35 additional people on top of that during the racing season. That involves recruiting, interviewing, training 35 new people each and every year. We are also challenged by the fact that working for the Racing Commission means you work all summer long, you work evenings, and you work every holiday. So maintaining groups that will do that consistently continues to be a challenge, but ultimately we have a dedicated team that understands the necessity of these hours and executes admirably each and every season. In general, the Racing Commission is confident we currently have the financial ability to provide proper oversight of the industry, which I might note continues to progress steadily and continues to grow, and maintain strict controls over our budgets and spending. And with that, if anyone has any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Well, Mr. Skirto, it's nice that word has gotten out about some of the line of questioning I've got. So we'll have you discuss your MINUTE my MINUTE questions, but we've got a couple of other members that actually requested to do that before me. Representative Eblum.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Yes, my question has to do with your in-house legal counsel. what, number one, what is your cost, fringes, benefits, so on and so forth with this in-house legal counsel? And then two, how much were you spending on outside legal advice and costs prior to your acquisition of this position?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ugham, let me answer the question qualitatively, and then Mr. Skirtle can answer with the numbers. I should disclose that I am a lawyer myself. I spent 29 years at 3M, so I came to this position with a good deal of regulatory legal background. And I was actually functioning essentially as the general counsel for the commission. In talking to my peers around the country, I found that the Racing Commission in Minnesota was one of the few that did not have a general counsel or staff attorney. We relied on the Attorney General's office historically, but they were reticent to get involved in anything that involved rulemaking or policy. They basically managed contested cases and provided occasional advice on data practices, compliance, and things of that sort. The Commission needs day-to-day legal advice, rules interpretations, as Mr. Skirtle mentioned, support for our stewards and judges. We were involved in two pieces of litigation in the last couple of years and some human rights complaints, which we've successfully defended. So I thought it was best to bring a general counsel in. To answer your question on the classification, I was looking for a person that could just get the job done. I happily found someone that was very experienced as a state lawyer, exceptional quality, and I just successfully reclassified her into a managerial position. So her salary has just changed from about $76,000 up to about $86,000. But that was a classification that went through SMART, the Department of Administration, and MMB, and it was approved at all levels.
Representative Eaglin. Okay, and then a follow-up, Director. So we have the salary, and then we have the fringes and benefits, and which is considerably more, another 25% or so. So what were your legal costs on a year-to-year basis to justify this position?
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I can answer that question. We have been spending approximately $40,000 to $45,000 a year with the Attorney General's office. We also had a staff member that was handling internally rules and rule writing and promulgation on staff that was earning with benefits probably in the range of $45,000 to $55,000 a year. So to say it was dollar for dollar, no, I don't believe we can say that. Yeah. On the other hand, the other things that this staff attorney brings to our organization, being available to consult with our stewards and judges through the year, is something that we certainly benefit from. I can tell you our last invoice from the Attorney General was $28 for the month. So we hope it continues to go in that direction.
Representative Eaglin?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Well, of course, service is important for your clientele and everything else, but I hope you know, anytime you go in-house with things, costs continue to rise, and it sounds to me like in terms of you have lawsuits that happen and you have spikes, but then you have, you know, peaks and valleys and things. So I applaud you for holding your costs down 1% less, things like that, but oftentimes things like this can get away from you sometimes too.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add, Mr. Chair, Representative Ugham, one of the things that I found when I came to the commission is the skill set on the commission staff, and as Mr. Skirtle said, we only have 9 or 10 people, did not match our legislative mandate. I made it clear that the expectations were a 3M level of performance. Some people accepted that level, and other people chose to retire or seek other employment. So the people that have been brought into the organization provide for a better skills match to our mission, and as Mr. Skirtle said, our costs have maintained. They've actually been reduced despite 3% salary increases each year.
That's good. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of the questions, I think, are answered and kind of rolled into my one. But on issue, don't have your pages numbered, but budget uses for 2017 and the one after on the budget increases for investments, you have payroll and fringe benefits going up 25%. But back on the page before that, you've got total expenditures going up 18%. How much of the total of that 18% is the 25% payroll, and I was trying to skim through this, but it's tough to do, so I'm just going to ask you. And where does the rest of the 18% come from?
Mr. Skirto?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is the vast majority of that. Our compensation costs are the majority of what is in our budget each year. So, and because we operate within actually over 9 different budgets, some of that is also due to the fact that it falls into the reimbursement budget. So we have taken on new employees and staff members that work during the racing season that at one point were Canterbury Park employees, and we felt since they were part of the medication testing that they needed to come under our umbrella. So some of those costs go into the compensation cost and then also roll into the total budget itself. But it is a vast majority of that, to answer your question.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Now, you're not coming for an ask this year, and I commend you for that. But with this increased budget, do you have any foreseeable asks for the future, for next year? Or do you have a budget that is now going to take care of this?
Mr. Skirto? Mr. DePasquale?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we feel we're in good, solid shape going forward. We never want to say never because you don't know what kind of cost that you don't anticipate. But when we look at our biennial budgets, we're looking at 3.5% each year as far as what we anticipate needing, and that's due primarily to union increases, payroll, and compensations.
Thank you. Mr. Skirto, Mr. DePasquale, if you would, let's tackle the IT piece. If you would, go through your budgets for that, how you came to that, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I think since Tom and I started, Tom, 3-plus years ago, myself 2.5 years ago, we've spent a lot of time with Minute. And they've been gracious enough to put up with us and spend a lot of time with us as well. The budget for fiscal year 17, when it was first presented to us by Minute, was approximately $140,000. Considering we were coming out of a fiscal year where we spent about $47,000, I did a backflip out of my chair. And the first call was, no, this is not going to work. They met with us. We ran through their assumptions. And we worked through it line by line, and they basically came back and said, okay, we agree with you, it's $103,000. And I said, that's not going to work either. We basically have $72,000 in our budget for your services, and we need to get to that point. Now, the good part about what Minute has done is gone to these enterprise rates. So at least we now have a menu knowing exactly what everything is going to cost us. And that is something that's a bit of advice I'd give to all agencies. When they tell you your budget's X, don't say okay. Go look at the rates. We ran down the menu, and we chose what we felt we needed the most. And there are certain services that they provide that we simply can't afford. And we tried to do things with even email that's gone from $16 to $19. Everybody on staff, including seasonal, used to get email addresses. Some of them are no longer getting email addresses. Tech support, there's a charge for 24/7 tech support, and then there's a charge for 40-hour-a-week tech support. During the summer, we may need 24/7. The rest of the year, we don't. So we line-itemed it, and I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to hit our budget figure of $72,000 that we have for fiscal year 17. It's still an increase, but a significant one. On the other hand, we are now on the state server, where we were previously on our own server, so we won't have the future expenses of having to make a capital investment into servers as well. And we've also, I think there's some general cost increases that you're probably well aware of that Minute has put through with cybersecurity and those sorts of things. And if I could float one idea to this committee, that idea would be, because of the success that we've seen with Smart dealing with small agencies, something to have a Minute involved in that type of setup to small agencies would be certainly something we would like to see pursued. Because if it comes down to, as far as a large agency getting help from Minute and the Racing Commission getting a phone call back or service, it's difficult. You know, I guess you can see who's going to get the first return phone call. And having someone that can react to small agencies and understand our costs and needs might be something in the future to look at.
Mr. Skrilla, help me understand. Before the consolidation, what was your IT cost and how did it roll out? How many people did you have? How many people do you have on site now from Minute? So previous cost, previous labor allocation, what do you have now?
Mr. Chair and committee members, prior to that we had one in-house individual that worked for the Racing Commission, and those costs were running us between $140,000 and $160,000 a year.
For salary?
For salary, including overtime,
okay,
as well as additional expenses that we had on top of that for IT, for maintenance agreements, service agreements, and so forth for the servers within our organization. When we first started, we took a look at that. Number one, we didn't feel we were getting the in-house service that we should have. But conversely, it was way too much for an organization that had an operational budget of approximately $890,000 to be spending that. That individual, what we basically told Minute, you can have that individual back, and we will take the service that we need at that time. So we were up in, you know, with spending almost $160,000, $170,000. I think that's what led Minute to saying this is your new budget. Conversely, where we are today is one quarter person in the budget, and we are discussing that with Minute right now, because one quarter of a person means we should have somebody on site at least one day a week or a couple days every couple weeks, and we really don't have that need because we were lucky enough to hire an individual as our compliance administrator that's got some IT skills and also helps us kind of get take care of the day-to-day stuff that we need internally.
Mr. Skrilla, as it relates to space allocated for that Minute person, and are they actually coming on site one day a week? Or,
Mr. Chair, no, they are not.
Okay. So back to the space allocation question that I've got. If they're not coming, are you still required to allocate space for this person if they ever show up to work for you? Or is that part of the carve-out you have for your office? Or,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Racing Commission does not pay any rent. It's to be provided by the racetracks themselves. So we do not allocate space, nor do we pay for space.
Okay. Well, that was very interesting. Let's get back to some other member questions. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, how many days of the year are there two tracks at operation, and how do they compare with tracks in the southern part of the states, or southern part of the United States?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, Running Aces has 53 live racing days. Canterbury has 70 live racing days. Of course, the tracks are open 364 days a year. They're closed on Christmas, and they do simulcast wagering in the card room, so and many other activities unrelated to racing that they host.
Representative, Mr. Chair and Director, I've always wondered, you know, these tracks are covered with snow for I don't know how many months of the year. Have you ever considered, or is it maybe it's a bad word to use, snowmobile racing?
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, there is snowmobile racing at Canterbury. They hosted an event just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
But it's a special event. It's not a year-round feature or a winter feature.
No pari-mutuel wagering.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Detmer,
is this something that the Racing Commission is maybe looking into? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, our jurisdiction extends only to regulating pari-mutuel racing, pari-mutuel wagering on horse racing,
okay,
which raises its own set of questions because, as you're well aware, there's fantasy sports wagering going on, which cannibalizes some of the pari-mutuel handle, and that's not currently within the scope of our regulatory authority.
Representative Detmer, are you going to be jacketing a bill for snowmobile racing?
I always wonder that because I live in Forest Lake, and, you know, Running Aces is right across the freeway there, and I see it not in operation for many, many days of the year. So just came across my mind.
Very good. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. One further question. Governor Dayton has just announced a big cybersecurity initiative and everything else. And given the fact that your IT costs are increasing and everything else. Have you had the opportunity to weigh in on that, or have you done any projected increased costing for this initiative?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have not budgeted any additional costs for that at this time. One thing I can say about Minute is they have begun routine meetings with small agencies that we have been asked to be a part of. Some we have, some we've been unable to. So we do feel at least there's been better communication, more input, but specifically to that, no, we have not.
Thank you.
Okay, last question for here is Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Matt. We've spent a lot of time in this committee talking about Minute and IT services and so forth, but I just wanted to make sure I understood, because I was just writing down some notes here. Prior to using Minute and their consolidated services, your IT costs were $140,000 to $160,000, and now with Minute, you're going to hopefully get it down to closer to $73,000 or something like that. Did I understand that correctly?
Mr. Skirto?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have the gambling control, Mr. Barrett. Welcome to the committee. If you would, state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board, and if it's all right with you, I didn't bring a PowerPoint presentation, but I thought I'd do a two-part.
God bless you for that.
All right. But a two-part presentation. One, a brief overview of the industry we regulate, and that's the charitable gaming industry. And then the second part, a little more focus on our agency operations, how we do what we do, and what some of the related costs are. So if that's okay with you, I'll be as brief as I can, but still leave a very good picture. Charitable gaming has been around a long time, obviously well before 1985 when the board was formally established under the state law. In the old days, there was bingo with navy beans on the card. There was something called a pickle card. Okay, that's simply because that was where the cards were, was in the old pickle jar. Today, though, we have five legal forms of charitable gaming: pull tabs, raffles, tip boards, paddle wheels, and did I say tip boards? Tip boards. Paddle wheel is not a paddle wheel riverboat. It's simply like the Wheel of Fortune. You spin the wheel, you might have seen that at your local bars with the meat raffles. Pull tabs by far are the biggest breadwinner for the charitable gaming industry, accounting for 93% of total sales. But when you look at the gross sales last fiscal year, which set a record for charitable gaming at $1.6 billion, tremendous volume. That puts Minnesota, once again, number one in the country in terms of the activity for charitable gaming. The industry we're keeping an eye on, we have 1,200 licensed charities. Licensed charities have a full gaming license. They're located at a bar, selling everything from the pull tabs, conducting bar bingo, raffles. We also have the equal number of gambling managers. If a charity wants to get involved in charitable gaming, they have to commit one of their members to go through the education, go through the background checks, be responsible for all that reporting. So we also license that those individuals as well. 2,800 gambling locations, primarily bars. We do have some off-site liquor stores and the like. Over 10,000 paid and volunteer employees that are conducting charitable gaming on behalf of the charities. We have 10 licensed manufacturers making the products for sale in Minnesota, 10 licensed distributors providing, bringing the product in and distributing to the charities, and over 100 salespersons that are knocking on the doors of the charities. Here's the latest product offering that. All those individuals I just mentioned, with the exception of 10,000 employees, sellers, go through background checks. So before they get a license here in Minnesota, we're doing the criminal, doing the financial background checks. Additionally, we have licensing. Our licensing staff issues over 4,000 exempt, tax-exempt permits. Now, these are relatively small permits, okay? But last year, the value of those relatively small permits amounted to over $40 million. Quite the volume. A little more on the numbers, and a lot of what I'm talking about is included in our little annual report that was left for your overview. But again, $1.6 billion in sales. With that said, 83% of that goes right back to the player in the way of prizes. Approximately 17%, or $252 million last year, got to the bottom line to the charities to be used for expenses and taxes, and really what the bottom line is all about, charitable donations. But out of that $252 million, the state collected nearly $56 million in gambling taxes. Charities reported $126 million in expenses, or roughly a little over 8 cents on the dollar. But what truly got to the bottom line, which is what it's all about, is $70 million available for charitable donations, charitable purposes. Local units of government also get a benefit, a piece of the action, whether by local ordinance or the goodwill of the charity. But last year, charities donated just over $11 million to local units of government. Veterans Posts, they account for 27% of the total licensed charities, one of the bigger numbers. But as we all know, what's happening out there with our Veterans Posts and the aging veteran, we're starting to see a slight decrease. But nonetheless, the opportunities afforded Veterans Posts for the use of proceeds to keep the lights on and those things have been very beneficial to the veterans. Bar owners, they also benefit from the conduct of charitable gaming in the way of rent, whether they take up a booth space in the bar area or the bar employee selling on behalf of the charity. And last year, the value of rent and compensation charities paid the bar owners was just over $24 million. So as you can see, charitable gaming is very big. Focusing on my agency, while we're number one in the country, we're one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. For every dollar spent on charitable gaming, less than 0.2 cents comes to my agency in the way of dedicated fees. We don't receive any general fund money. It's all based on the fees that we charge the manufacturers, percentage of the charity sales, those kinds of things. So 100% goes into the dedicated fund from which you appropriate our operation. Our makeup of the board, we have a 7-member citizen advisory board. 5 are appointed by the governor, 1 is appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and 1 is appointed by the Attorney General. And there's a mix. We try to stay regulatory focused and politically neutral for obvious reasons. I have great staff, 33 in number, with an equivalent, full-time equivalent count, about 31 and a half. We have some part-times. We have 4 divisions. Compliance, that's the biggest division, made up of what I would call auditors. These are the folks that get out to the charities, get out to the sites, do the compliance checks, do the report auditing. Those are the folks I would love to say get out every year. But given the number of sites, number of organizations, and the staffing, roughly it's about once every 2 years, a little over 2 years. Now, if we get a hot site or an allegation or complaint, we're on that relatively quick. That includes our unit, what we call investigations. We get an allegation or we suspect there's some wrongdoing going on, that's where we'll send the staff out right away, not wait for the compliance review. We also have licensing. These are the folks that, before your product hits the street or charity sells at Pull Tab, they go through the background. They have to be in operation for a minimum of 3 years. In other words, you can't just, hey, let's, you and I get together, we'll create a charity and get into gambling. You have to be a registered charity for a period of 3 years and also have at least 15 active members. So there's some protocol involved that it doesn't just happen that charities create themselves to get into charitable gaming. Administration, again, with 33 staff, we have a very small administrative staff involving our human resources, accounting, which is basically one person, but also some clerical and receptionists. Our budget. Annual budget based on last fiscal year was at $3.3 million. 92% of that budget is made up of salaries and rent. Beyond that, it's the operational expenses, be it our travel and the like. But we have implemented a number of what I would obviously consider cost-effective measures over the last few years that you might not have heard about but have benefited not only the industry but our operation. We got into perpetual licensing. Prior to a few years ago, we would ask these charities to go through the local units government and send us all the forms and all the. We got rid of that. We still require local approval first. If the cities are okay with the charity going into their local bar, and then the state takes over. If there's no problems, it's an annual renewal. We still hit them up for the annual fee, but it's really cut down on the paperwork and the processing, so that's been good. We also have implemented electronic reporting. Everything before was all paper. But now with electronic reporting, we somewhat joke with these charities, if you want our attention, ignore us. And by that I mean forget to file your monthly report. We're going to know right away. If they're missing a couple of reports, they're missing something else. So there's been some real help in that sense. We talked about going outside our office with web design, and one of our staff person came in with some experience, so we saved a tremendous amount by having that person design our website, which I would put up second to none because it's very informative in terms of all our annual reports, detailed reports of any charity that's in your district. You can look up in that sense. How do we regulate? Number of ways, training, education, like I mentioned, also the background checks. But before a gambling manager is licensed, they're required to take two-day tests or two-day training, pass the test. We also do mentoring. Unfortunately, we have some situations where a gambling manager up and moves south, whatever, dies, unfortunately. Then we'll get into some one-on-one mentoring just to allow the charity to continue operating but make sure they know the requirements for what it business is all about. I mentioned compliance audits, site inspections. We work cooperatively with our counterparts of public safety. We'll do what we call sweeps. We'll target a town in a geographic location, Minnesota, and we'll be stopping at those sites. They'll be doing the compliance checks. I think public safety committee heard public safety presentation similar, but they're in there looking for the liquor, or the untaxed liquor. We're looking at compliance with the games and the like. But we work real close with those folks as well as revenue. Taxes are a big part of this industry, and so we work close with them on prompt reporting to those folks. Newsletter website, again, information that we get out there as best we can. Crime alerts, you know, we get people in a geographic area passing counterfeit bills. Those are all helpful information to protect the charity, protect the bottom line. And then finally, reports, not just our annual report, but we also have what I call five-star rating reports where you can go in and look at a charity in your area and simply by a five-star, meaning they've achieved at least met the minimum or the requirements for donations. The fewer the stars, the more issues they get in terms of maintaining expenses and get money to the bottom line. But it's a real quick resource for anybody, including the charities or members of the charities, to see how they're operating. And then as a last resort, yes, we are regulatory, so we do have opportunities, issue fines, citations, suspend the license, revoke the license. Our intent is not to put a charity out of business. It's to correct if they got some problems going on. As I said, we're regulatory-focused, politically neutral. We've had calls from different representatives, how can you do this to the charity? And then my question is, what did they tell you? And normally we kind of get to the bottom of it. But if anybody's got any issues, be it your districts or whatever, on a charitable gaming, happy to provide feedback in those cases. We also work close with our tribal counterparts. A lot of the pull tab games that are offered charitable gaming are also available, if they want them, to tribal entity, tribal casinos. Occasionally, and it's very rare, but occasionally we'll find a game that has a manufacturing defect, so we'll do a recall. So we work with the distributors. If there's a recall in the charitable gaming market and it was offered for sale at Tribal, they're also made aware of those recalls. We're not the lottery. We're not the racing commission, but we do get together occasionally, compare notes, especially as you heard some of the impact on fantasy sports. And Sunday we got the Super Bowl. Does everybody have their numbers? Okay, that'd be a no. But, you know, this is a form of illegal gambling, and we know it's out there. Public safety knows it's out there. But it's one of those things that takes away from charitable gaming. Could it become legal? Just by way of background, the state of New Jersey is challenging the federal law regarding sports wagering. There's a law in the Minnesota books right now that would allow the Gambling Control Board and charities to offer a tip board game very similar to this based on the outcome of a sporting event. But with the federal law prohibiting states from getting involved, with the exception of the four states when the law was passed in 92, the rest of the states can't be involved. So we went back and said, well, you passed the law and the governor signed it, protecting the state's interest because the major sports leagues went after the state of New Jersey to challenge it. So right now we have a challenge in front of the courts affecting New Jersey, and all the other states are waiting to see how that goes before we move forward.
Mr. Baer, we've got a couple of member questions, but why don't we jump into the IT piece real quick, if you would.
No, absolutely. That was if I could, with just finishing the trends.
Yeah, please.
Because it's helpful to understand that this is the seventh year in a row charitable gaming has increased sales. So when that's happening, everybody's benefiting. The state, obviously, in the tax collections, bottom line to the charities, the borrowers collecting the rent. The electronic monitoring. We do have the electronic pull-tab games out there, electronic link bingo. And we see regulatory-wise, I don't want to sound like I'm promoting, but regulatory-wise, we see tremendous advantages benefiting us to keep an eye on that industry in terms of that activity. And if there's time for another data to come back and show some of the activity. But that's one of the more common questions I've been asked. How are things going with those electronic pull tabs? And if you can see the chart where it started out relatively low and now it's continuing on the rise. And that's an indication that the industry is starting to accept it, benefiting, again, the charities and the like, and the state, everybody that gets in line. We've implemented a lot of new law change the last few years, benefiting both our regulatory efforts as well as easing some of the burden on the charities. Hopefully, if they were to come before you, they'd support that as well. But it's not like we never keep looking. We're always looking. But with that said, we're not proposing any policy changes this year, so I don't think we'll be coming back unless you ask us on a budget. But we don't propose any policy changes at this time. But if it pleases you, I'll get right into the two change requests affecting our IT as well as our the governor's recommendations.
Yes, please.
All right. Including our budget requests are two supplemental funding requests. The first one is what I'm pretty sure other state agencies received recently when the governor released their budget, but it includes salary operational adjustment for the gambling control board amounts to approximately $45,000 the first year, and the second year where we get to the $80,000. That's to cover the salary adjustments, bargaining unit adjustments, insurance costs, and pension adjustments. I believe what we were allocated or recommended for approval is in line with the other state agencies. There is some amount benefited to rent and some of those costs. We're not projecting we have our headquarters and three regional offices, and we're not projecting any increase in rent costs significant in that sense, so we didn't get a bump. I mean, there attention to that detail. But it remains to be seen what the bargaining unit agreements come in. But that was one of the supplemental budget requests as recommended by the governor and MMB. The second request does bring into the fold the IT expense as relates to Minute. Our current situation right now, we're not fully transitioned in the Minute simply because we couldn't afford it. We've been working. Counterparts from Racing Commission did a very good job representing how the small agencies are impacted by the services either provided or recommended by Minute. Now, it is a law that eventually this consolidation will happen, and Minute's been understanding in terms of we can't afford without changes. Now, with that said, we do have some existing money that we have been appropriated over the years that we use for our licensing software, our regular Microsoft software license applications, our wide area network, the VoIP phone system, web hosting, and then a relatively small amount for equipment. That money in our existing budget, presumably when the time is right, transfers officially to Minute. But with that said, our servers that we have right now under our possession that we purchased are getting a little outdated. So Minute has put together a menu plan, as you heard again, with the Racing Commission. We're sitting down with them trying to tweak as well because simply we didn't have the money for everything that they were telling us we needed. But we understand, we embrace what they represent, they Minute, in terms of the security and the protection and the good counsel of a system. But it comes with a price, and it's something that we weren't used to. We didn't have an IT person. We don't have an IT person on our staff. We happen to take our licensing supervisor that gained some of the IT experience over the years and is the one that's pretty much, you know, making sure that all the data is backed up on the servers or the right equipment is ordered. So we didn't have a staff person to give up. That same person is going to be focusing a little more time on his licensing duties. But with that said, Minute's offering to get us in the right frame with our workstations, the monitors, and as we found out recently, they did come out with a new plan that we could kind of pick and choose one that fits within our budget, hopefully, but one that will at least get us in the same framework, literally, with minutes. So we're kind of being told, you know, what we need, and that's what we put forward to you.
And, Mr. Barrett, if you could, we're just trying to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples.
Yep.
Fairly. Well, your fiscal year 14, there's no number for that. Can you get us what that number was that you actually spent on internal? Yes.
Yep.
And you don't have to do that now. You can just get that to us. You can get that. But, yeah, I would like to follow up with you afterwards. There's a lot of questions that I've got that would love to go through with you.
I'd love to bend your ear. Again, as our racing commission talked about, that's where we're at. And I know we got representatives here for a minute, and we've worked with them. But, you know, big is better, little. But sometimes we don't get the attention. The cybersecurity that came out, I think a lot of that's focused on the bigger agencies, rightfully so, a lot to shoot at when you're a big target. But when you look at the industry that we're trying to keep track of and the millions of dollars and the operations, we have a pretty good system, but we understand the vulnerability. So.
Very good. And I will say, coming from municipal government, everybody's happy with the new reporting. It was a very cumbersome activity back when I was a mayor. It was really kind of a pain.
I appreciate that. And I know the League of Minnesota Cities and Lake, we're a little concerned, but we still afford the local units the first right of refusal if you don't want, for some reason, that charity in your community. But once they're approved, we monitor and keep them on the straight and narrow.
Nope, it was good. We'll move on to member questions. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, I'm only asking questions because I've had a couple of concerns from my area with some folks that do the charitable gaming. And the amount that's left for charity work is getting to the point where they can't even find volunteers to do it. Do you have any numbers? Are we losing numbers of people that are doing this because it doesn't seem to be worth it?
Mr. Barrett.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, very good question, and I'll try to do a two-part quick answer. We do see, in the old days, it was all primarily volunteers. You know, for the good of the charity, let's do this. Let's step in and run the meat raffle or sell this. We don't. Those days are starting to fade away. So in order to get somebody to help, you got to pay them. In that respect, there's a concern. I know they some charities like, we can't find anybody that's interested, even if you pay them. And to that, the board has said, then it maybe isn't that important. If you can't find somebody that committed to help your charity and get to the bottom line, then you need to make the choice. And that's unfortunately where we see some of the veterans post either merging or giving up their gambling license. The other component is what's getting to the bottom line. And I'm sure if the charities were invited up here, you would hear the money that's going to the bar owners, the monies that are going to local units of government, the money that's going to taxes. The board hears that, but again, we're neutral in that respect. But when you look at it and say, well, geez, out of every dollar spent, roughly a nickel gets to that donation bottom line. But yet, when you're looking at $1.6 billion in gross sales, all those nickels add up. But that's where some of the charities stand back and go, is it worth this effort to report, to pay somebody to account for it? But that's where the board has worked to say, of your increase, the star rating. We see organizations that have high expenses. We try to focus with those. Is there ways to save money? You would hear the charities, geez, we pay the CPAs and the accountants X amount. All those things are still important. Can they shop around for better rates? They could. Even the products, pull tabs. What one distributor offers might be cheaper than another one. So we encourage organizations. They have choices if they're looking to save money or if they're just looking to be compensated. But those are the points that I think are ahead in front of the industry right now in terms of, do they want to stay a part of it? Again, seventh year in a row now for record sales, so sales are doing well. But it's trying to keep the charities interested. Maybe that's too long of an answer. But
no, that's fine. That's a good answer. The other question is, you had prizes paid out at over 83%, and that sounds great, but is there any, for two questions, is there any movement to maybe lower that percentage and help and stick more to the charities? And the other question is, is there an attempt or is there a way, are we double taxing? Are we taxing when we come in to do the charity, and are we taxing the prizes?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep. With respect to the prize payout, and that's a good question. You would think, well, geez, we just lower the prize payout more to the bottom line. And yet, more than a few years ago, there was that very discussion. And so it was floated, instead of the law with the cap of 85, there was actually a bill proposed to lower that. And then you heard from all the charities and manufacturers, and it's a competitive deal. If you lower the prize payout, the players are going to go elsewhere. You have a tribal casino, our counterparts at the lottery, those kinds of things. So there was much discussion, but it's actually as you raise the prize payout, it generates more interest, more sales. The technical term is the churn, more games. So that was the concern. So just by lowering it, we were amazed, the board was amazed, when it was first offered, and then they actually came back from the industry saying, no, there's a sense of balance. You still got to get some money to the bottom line, mindful of the expenses, mindful of the taxes. With regard to double taxation, I'm not sure I truly understand, but again, if a player is winning, depending upon the amount they win, they're taxed as an individual, so that's kind of a separate element. But if it's a tax that's based on the, right now, and I don't want to get in trouble, the tax policy that's in play, we have five forms of gaming, but again, pull tabs, raffles, bingo. Depending upon what game you play, you're taxed at different rates. So that by itself is a little complicated in terms of what organizations pay. But even with the tax on pull tabs, the more you sell, the higher the tax rate. So if you're a relatively small organization, you can get by relatively cheap tax rate-wise. But if you're a big organization, top one, Merrick, out of Adonis Heights, $17 million last year in sales, they're paying the higher tax rate simply because they have the most activity. So all these organizations have to keep in mind as they're making money, what's the effective rate the next month if you get into the higher tax rate. So I'm not sure if your charity is in your area, but I know the charity representatives have been knocking on doors. Taxes are a significant concern in the respect of survival and what they're paying. But, again, the benefits of the state receiving it, too.
Representative Green? Good? Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you.
A question about the annual report on page 9 and 10, where it talks about the amount of money, 10% per year, that a city or county can require of an organization. Yep. Then I look at some of the balances that are there. Maple Grove, for example, has a balance of $317,000. Now, to me, that seems like a heck of a big balance to be carrying. Why wouldn't they be administering or spending that money on police, fire, training, whatever the area needs?
Yep. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Very good question. It's one of the reasons why we put this out publicly, is just to keep it in front of everybody what's donated to local units of government. But a good example, and I don't know for sure, but a lot of times local units of government will save the money for the purchase of a fire rig. And fire rig these days are upwards of $250,000, $300,000. At the same time, they've spent other smaller amounts on life-saving. But this is one of those things that if, you know, you're in that area, or go back to the local unit and say, hey, we got this much money there. Not spent, but yeah, as you see, they didn't spend anything. That normally tells the board they're saving for a big ticket purchase, but you can still knock on their door, local units, say, can we use this for the parks? Is this available, you know, for something like that?
Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's no requirement that there be any spend down of that balance. Each local government can determine their own needs in that regard.
Mr. Barrett.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, correct. There's no, but we do monitor.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be the board's position to knock on Maple Grove and go, what are you going to spend it on? But right. Normally what we see is the charity step up in that respect because they're contributing to local unit right. Government. So,
okay. Thanks.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, my question is a little bit like Bepson Green here. I chair the Veterans Committee, and I've had a lot of VFWs, American Legions, coming to me, and we're losing a lot of them around the state. And one of the big reasons is the the lawful gambling taxes that they have to pay, as you mentioned before, that as your gambling increases, your tax increases, I think all the way up to 34%. So what? Who sets the tax rates on charitable gambling? Is it the legislature or?
Mr. Barrett.
It's you.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Is Representative Demmer?
Yes.
Okay. Let's make that get in the record there.
So we have Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer.
So we have House File 226 coming into being, which I've already dropped. And what basically that will do is after, say, American Legion VFW donates into the community. Mm-hmm. I know I coached for many years at the high school level when we always went to the VFW, Legion, and so forth for funds. After they do their donations, then they will be taxed on the money that's left. So that's basically what my bill will do. So,
okay. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, does the Gambling Control Board have direct interaction with the Minnesota Gambling Helpline?
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We don't have direct interaction with the board, but one of the requirements is that those sites that offer charitable gaming, they have the compulsive gambling hotline number available. It's one of their checkoffs and our site inspections. We go in to see there's house rules and appropriate and as well as that.
Representative Fenton?
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a yes or no answer, and you can get us the details later if it's yes. You had touched on that many charitable organizations are now going out and hiring people to run the fundraising activity. Are there any irreputable or questionable organizations going around trying to find entities to say, we'll do it for you, or there have been bad situations? If the answer is yes, if you could get the committee the information, it would be useful. Thank you.
Mr. Barrett.
I'll say no, Mr. Chair. I'll say no with a qualifier. Okay. The very nature of what we do, $1.6 billion, all cash, 10,000-plus employees, a lot of them volunteer, 2,800 locations that serve alcohol. What could go wrong? But unfortunately, it does sometimes. We just had a recent news article where there's embezzlement happen out in Shakopee. Those things happen. So when I mentioned the gambling manager goes through the training and the background checks, those are the key folks that we depend on to do the right thing in reporting. To the extent that they hire somebody that might not be have the best interest in mind, that's when we do get involved and we see examples of some of the sales. But in terms of having a license to come in and sell, we've had a number of vendors that wanted to come in and offer their products. Well, if they don't go through the licensing background, they stay out of Minnesota. So there's some reasonable assurances. Those that are involved in charitable gaming, for the most part, are doing the right thing. It's when they don't, that's when we kind of keep an eye on things.
That was a great yes or no answer.
I think the answer would be no, to rest easy.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, nice to see you. And good, interesting presentation, as always. It's just quickly, I was wondering why some of these folks don't have a report that they turned in, some of the communities. It just seems kind of stood out to me. So I just was curious, and then I have another question.
Yeah. Representative, Mr. Barrett.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. We did reach out with that example because, we can only wait so long for the report.
Sure.
So for those that you see did not report, we do first reach out to charities. Did you give money to the local units of government, or did they for some reason stop? But we also reach out to local units of government. We send them, whether it's a letter, followed up with a phone call. But in his last resort, we had the opportunity to meet with the state auditor, not legislative auditor, but the state auditor. And we shared some notes from our regulatory perspective of things we see at the local unit just to see, do we refer to you if they have the jurisdiction over that local unit? But that's where we try to follow up. And we actually get some response from the charities knowing that they paid money to that city and then we eventually get it out. But we had to put this to press, and that's what we had.
Sure.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Barrett. I always find this really interesting, and I'm fairly close to Vadna site, so I'm always curious what they have going on there, because it's just a pretty big operation, it looks like, and you can comment if you want. But I like on page 7 in particular, I thought it was interesting where some of these organizations around the state really compound the money that goes in. And so they're not only sending out a buck, they're one of them in Caledonia is sending out, like, for each dollar spent, they're spending $15. So it's, you know, it's really fascinating. So thank you. I know a lot of these local communities really do the money's going to good work in the communities, that, and I'm glad to hear that's kind of coming up because, you know, we mentioned the one that might have the reserves, but that might be a big fire truck. And I, you know, the chair being out of city council realizes how expensive they were. I was that, but a lot of it goes to smaller items, but it's a lot of that goes to good work. So thank you.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, if I can,
Mr. Barrett, your final word
to us. This isn't it, because they're not necessarily big, but they're very efficient in their maintaining the, keeping the cost down and get more money to the bottom line. So that's why the board elected to do. I will take the opportunity of adding the sites or follow up with you separately, because occasionally we'll get calls from local units of government. They want to pass an ordinance. They want to restrict money in their leaving their community. And with that said, there's a provision in law that said if you're a local unit of government like Vadnais and they want to restrict money going outside the city of Vadnais, the law says that's fine, but it also is going to include the contiguous cities around Vadnais. And they didn't like to hear that, and we're still working with them on that, but that's what the law says. So it keeps everybody working together.
Mr. Barrett, thank you for your time here before the committee today. And members, if you have questions, I would recommend finding Mr. Barrett offline. Thank you very much for being here, Mr. Barrett. Next, we've got the Minnesota State Lottery. If you can make your way down. Welcome to the committee. Members, in the essence of time, we've got about, what do we have, about 40-some-odd minutes or less. So keep that in mind as we ask questions. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, Nash, and members of the committee. I am Michael Vekich and serve as the acting executive director of the Minnesota Lottery. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to present and to provide an overview of our operations as well as our budget. I would like to introduce the lottery's executive team that's with me today, Joel Paul, the chief financial officer, Don Feeney, who's the director of planning and research, Ben Friedland, who's the lottery's general counsel, and to my left is Chris Kwapik, our legislative liaison. Now, before we get into some of our budget details, I would like to provide you with a brief history and overview of the lottery in Minnesota. In 1998, the Minnesota voters approved through a constitutional amendment the creation of the Minnesota Lottery, and we began selling our first tickets in April of 1990. Later the same year, voters again went to the polls and approved a 40% dedication of all lottery proceeds to the newly created Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. That dedication was extended in 1998 until 2025. Since 1990, it has been the lottery's mission to raise money for the trust fund as well for the state's general fund, game and fish fund, and the natural resources fund. Please turn your attention to the slide with a dollar bill on it. This is a high-level breakdown of where the money goes when you purchase your lottery ticket. I hope you all purchase a lottery ticket from time to time. The vast majority of the money goes back into the prizes for our players at about 62%. Vendor costs as well as commissions to our retailers total about 9.3%, and the administrative costs for the lottery operations is about 4.2%. The remaining 24% goes back to the four state funds I just mentioned. On top of that, I should note, an additional $2.2 million is made available every year from the Lottery Prize Fund to the Minnesota Department of Human Services for programs associated with addressing problem gambling help and prevention. Since the inception, the lottery has returned to the state of Minnesota $2.6 billion. A figure that I can tell you that every employee at our agency is proud of. Bringing us back to the past year, I am also pleased to report to you, the committee, that the lottery had a very productive and prosperous year. A record $592 million in tickets were sold in FY16, resulting in a record of $145 million back to the state of Minnesota. While this record year was definitely bolstered by a $1.6 billion Powerball jackpot at this time last year, strong scratch sales constituted about two-thirds of our business. We managed record sales while keeping our operational costs flat at about $27 million. Moving to our budget and operations, the committee may recall that the lottery does not receive any funding from the general fund. Instead, the lottery operates using funds collected from our sale of our tickets. However, every 2 years, this committee and its counterpart in that other body set an operations cap in the state government finance omnibus bill. For fiscal years 16 and 17, the lottery has this cap set at $31 million for each respective year. A breakdown of our operating expenses and revenues can be found on the back page of our agency profile that should be included in your packets. With that, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and present the lottery, and we will stand for your questions.
And members, as you know, the lottery is exempt, so I will mercifully not be asking you any IT questions.
Thank you.
Representative Green, did you have a question?
I just have one, Mr. Chair. On the budget, on the back page, it says that the actual for 2016 was $26 million plus, but it doesn't include the pension liability adjustments. Do you know what those are?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they do include the pension adjustment. It is about negative $1.5 million. For the previous year.
Representative Green?
I guess I don't understand that. There's a little asterisk there that says does not account for pension liability adjustments. And are you telling me that there's a negative, that I would reduce that amount if you add in the pensions?
All right.
So explain it to me.
We'll do a phone a friend, if you would. Introduce yourself to the committee.
Joe Paul, Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota State Lottery. On the budget document you are looking at, it does not include that adjustment for pensions on there. The actual operating, if you looked at our financial statements, would show about $1.6 million less in operating expenses for 2016. And approximately a little over $1 million less in 2015. And the reason for that is a pension adjustment. Basically, our pensions made more than the actuarial estimates, which we put on our financial statements as essentially a negative expense, which is reducing our operating costs. So if you compared this budget document to our actual financial statements would not line up exactly, but this is our actual expenditures here. This is what we spent, so it's not the pension adjustment is a paper adjustment that we did not want to have included in here.
Representative Green.
So you're telling me that your pension plan's in the black and you're making money?
No. I wish it were. This is statewide. Everybody, even the state of Minnesota, their pension, we just take a portion of their pension and put that on our books relative to the size of our payroll. And so the state is not in the black as a whole. They're just a little less negative than they were the year before.
Okay, members, other questions? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming today. Representative Johnson here wanted me to ask why he's a Norwegian, why he wasn't asked to be in the calling all Vikings in the for the advertising. But I'm sure you can answer the question off.
I'll do that offline, Mr.
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
I appreciate on page two with all the money that is raised, you know, for our coffers. It's pretty impressive. I had an opportunity to serve on the LCCMR for 2 years, and I know that those folks that are on that committee take that money very seriously and try to do good work. And a lot of it's science-based items that I thought were really interesting projects. One of them that always kind of stood out to me was to invest in, you know, finding out if cattails, for example, could be used as biomass we'd hate for funding necessarily to go into that straight up out of the budget, but the LCCMR money that you guys help fund is a perfect area for kind of a risky research or just, you know, doing science work. So, anyways, I just think it'd be nice to see a list of all that stuff, and you might have that on your website or LCCMR, but that's always interesting.
Mr. Chair, we'll provide that for you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I know when the lottery came to be years back, one of the things that was advertised was that amount of money that would be going into public education. I don't see that listed here. Is it because it goes in the general fund and then, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand it was a mere child back when when the lottery came into being, but at that time there was a discussion around education, but that was not the final decision on allocation. So it goes into the general fund and then reallocated.
Right, yeah.
Representative Lilly, remember we have...
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank this group for funding people that do struggle with addiction and stuff, and that stood out to me, and I've had in the past some groups come in my office and say that absolutely zero people are addicted to any of this, which, you know, of course, zero is virtually impossible, but thank you for funding it, and believe me, as one legislator, I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you.
Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Minnesota Sports Commission.
Is that offline?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And we do have brief time, so...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. And with me is Neil Ladd, the Associate Director of the Amateur Sports Commission.
Thank you very much. Proceed.
Just real quickly, since we're short on time, basically just wanted to make sure that most of you may have either been to one of our facilities. Some of you border our facility. There's no one here that directly represents it. But the agency is a small agency. There are three state employees, and we have as you can see, we have a budget of about $300,000 a year. And from that, though, it's a little tricky to sort of explain how it works, because we actually have an authority that we have a nonprofit entity called the National Sports Center Foundation, and that's where the bulk of the employees are that run our flagship facility, which is the National Sports Center in Blaine, which is something everyone should be quite proud of. It's the world's largest soccer facility and the world's largest ice facility. However, we're a little nervous. We're in jeopardy of losing that moniker, as there's Massachusetts is talking about building a 10-sheet ice facility, so we're trying to keep that. We're looking at that as a potential lose that as our badge of honor. But so basically, the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission has helped facilitate the building of 12 structures, 12 amateur athletic facilities throughout the state. We only run one of them, but we've served as the bonding authority for the others, most recently in Marshall, Minnesota, which a two-sheet facility down there in called the Red Baron Ice Arena, which is really quite a nice facility down in Marshall. Our goal is pretty straightforward and simple. It's to create economic opportunity through amateur sport, and again, we have a $600,000 biennial budget We actually turned that, though, into a very conservative economic estimate. We have a professor from St. Thomas who's on our board who's helped it, and we've used it all over. Roughly $43 million in economic impact at the sports facility alone. If you go statewide to other facilities, it's closer to $70 million. Again, some of you, I've seen you up there participating at our USA Cup. We just had a record year, almost 1,200 teams from 20 countries. Referees from 120 referees from multiple countries that come up and spend their vacation there and spend the time there. And probably most importantly, though, is the number of kids who get to play and participate in the sport. We do one other thing that a couple of other things. We administer two grant programs, one for the Hennepin County Ballpark Authority, and the second, some of you who are recipients of it here around your table, is the James, been renamed after former Senator James Metzen, the Mighty Ducks grant program. And if you dig a little deeper into our funding, you'll see that it looks like we have a little bit bigger number, but that's a carry-forward number, and that money is just a pass-through that we distribute as people apply for that funding.
Well, Mr. Johnson, I can speak to the economic impact, having six kids, all of whom play soccer, one who has played in many, many tournaments up there. It is a huge economic impact to the area. And I think I'm one of the biggest soccer fans here, in part because of the many hours we spent there. So quick question for you, and you know where I'm going.
Yep.
So let's dive into the IT questions. Help us understand, you know, where you are now spend-wise, where you were pre-consolidation, what's the recommended budget, and are you able to, as we've heard some other folks having difficulty in finding the money for that?
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've been the executive director for now for 2 years, and prior to my existence as the executive director, I believe there was an affiliation with Minute. However, we have none. We don't have any at all right now. We actually do all of our IT services through the National Sports Center Foundation. So that is a zero budget item for us.
Okay. See? Short, sweet, to the point. Okay, member questions, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is with regard to funding. I'm looking at a sheet here that highlights, I'm not sure if it's a grant program for childhood obesity.
Right.
And I'm also wondering if you receive any federal funding.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the grant program you're referring to was a joint grant program through the Department of Education. It was for childhood obesity, and that grant has expired. That funding was actually, we did some pretty innovative and interesting things with a couple of the mobile home parks that adjoin our facility, and really we're doing the targeting at sort of kids who aren't traditional athletes and looking for ways for them to participate in sport and activity, food monitoring, that sort of thing, but that program is ending at the end of this year. We do not Mr. Chair, we do not, second part of your question, we don't receive any federal funding.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that program is through the Minnesota Department of Education. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Other member questions? Representative Kunesh-Badin.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question. Do you host international events?
I could answer that for you, but... Yeah, Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we do. We actually host the second largest international soccer tournament in the world.
Okay.
Let's take up.
Thank you. How will some of the new immigration laws or regulations affect some of these international events?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not sure. We're gauging that as you know, or as the chair knows, we do have a large contingent of international. We had 20 teams last year from, or 20 countries, multiple teams from Mexico and all over. So far, to this point, we have a recruiting team, and they're telling us there hasn't been any loss of interest. We're hoping to set another record next year. You know, obviously there'll be some problems potentially with people concerned about visas, but we're not anticipating anything. Amateur sport, we're actually trying to go the other way. We're on the cusp of getting teams from Cuba, And if we're able to do that this year, we're pretty excited about what that would mean to have the first youth teams abroad from Cuba at that age, at 10 and 11-year-old, a boys and a girls team.
Representative Kunis Perdine?
Are any of the countries that are at this point being requested not to, that are having their green cards or their visas not honored, are any of those, are there participants in those countries that it might greatly affect?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not to my knowledge, the countries that are participating, that have participated and that we're targeting are not on those lists. And literally talked to Aaron Schmidt, who is our recruiter, and he is just got back from, I think it was just in Spain, I was going to say in Europe, and the timing might have been exactly the same, but, people were asking them questions about the election, but they're really trying to figure out where they're going to stay because we run out of hotel space in the area. So,
thank you.
Very good. Yeah, and I'll just chime in there. The teams are from everywhere. We've played teams from Mexico, Norway. I think we played some from Belgium, Spain. I've been there with my kids since, 2003, somewhere in there, and it's helped my son, who is now playing at the collegiate level, perfect his skills. So it's a great opportunity if you love soccer like I do, and if you don't like soccer, come with me and we'll convert you. It's a great time, and it's a really neat facility up there. And I know that it has really helped spur economic development in and around the facility. There's tons of restaurants, lots of hotels that are always full and impossible to get into. So great opportunity to push and develop youth sports. Very, very good facility.
Thank you.
Member questions? Representative Eaglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would, this is more of a comment, too. You border my district. I represent Champlin and Coon Rapids, and the National Sports Center does a wonderful job. And that Schwann's Cup is unbelievable. We used to host family, some of the Irish team that came over, and just an immense economic impact for the North Metro area. I might also say that you do have a little bit of a safety problem and a bonding request in, too, for one of the roads, which personally I know is very, very dangerous at this point in time because of the influx of people. But it's a great facility. The sheets of ice aren't too bad either, Representative Lilly. So that's a good thing, too. Huh?
Even when they're pink, I bet.
Okay, there you go. Thank you.
Members, other questions? Gentlemen, thank you for being here. And members, with that, we are adjourned.